Hello, I'm Ed Stocker and you're listening to The Big Interview. My guest today is a celebrated Chilean-American author and one of the world's most widely read Spanish language writers of all times, Isabel Allende. A famed storyteller, her books are sprinkled with humour, history and plenty of personal experience. Allende has received many accolades over her career, from Chile's National Literature Prize to the Presidential Medal of Freedom, awarded to her by Barack Obama in 2014. In addition to her work as a writer, Allende established the Isabel Allende Foundation in honour of her late daughter, dedicated to the protection and empowerment of women and children worldwide. And I'm pleased to say I have Isabel Allende right here with me in the studio in New York City today. Isabel Allende, a pleasure to have you here in the studio on a rather damp, miserable day in New York, but I'm sure you're going to brighten it up. I wanted to start off really asking you, you know, you've had a long, illustrious career. Was there a moment when you knew that you wanted to be a writer or kind of launch yourself into writing?
After I wrote The House of the Spirits, my first book, and it became a successful story, one of those very rare successful books, first novel. And then I thought, oh my God, this is just a wonderful thing. I don't have to be serving coffee to a male boss. I can be independent. This is great. And I have so many stories to tell. So that's maybe the moment when I thought vaguely that I could be a writer, but I didn't think I could make a living.
But you actually had a career before your first novel as a journalist. Did you almost, I don't know, fall into becoming a novelist by accident? You know, this first novel started as a letter to your grandfather. Did you suddenly one day think, oh my gosh, I've become a novelist?
Well, I had a career as a journalist in Chile before the military coup. But in 1973, we had a military coup. I got out of my country, and then I couldn't find a job as a journalist for years and years. So in 1981, when I wrote The House of the Spirits, I wasn't thinking that I was writing a book until the book was done. And then I didn't think it was a book until somebody read it, and that was an agent in Spain who became interested in the book. But the idea of me as a writer, of signing in a form that I'm a writer, that came much later with my third novel.
I mean, how does it feel, this first book, you know, worldwide success, publishers clamoring to sign it? Did you feel a certain amount of pressure after releasing a first book with such acclaim to then kind of go on and do the same, repeat the same from then on?
Well, I was living in Venezuela, pretty isolated from everything. I had no idea what the literary world was all about. I had never read a book review in my life, like most normal people. And my agent said, anybody can write a good first book. The writer is proven on the second book. And I wasn't aware of the success of The House of the Spirits at the beginning because it happened in Europe. By the time I got a brown envelope with the checks, I was already halfway through the second book to prove to my agent that I could write. So things happened slowly, and everything seemed like a bonus, like something extraordinary that happened, and I wasn't expecting it.
Obviously, that debut we've been talking about references or incorporates magical realism, but you've got a range of styles and influences. Maybe you can just give us an idea of what's really marked you in terms of writers during your career.
My greatest influence was not style. It was about storytelling. It was the passion for storytelling.
Where does that come from, your passion for storytelling?
I think the radio novela. Yeah, when I was very young, my grandfather forbade the radio at home because it had vulgar influences and he hated the noise. But in the kitchen, the radio was always on. And the radio was on the soap operas, the radio soap operas. So I grew up with this twins that go blind and marry the priest, and then the priest is not the priest but the prince, and so forth. I love those stories.
Do you still consume them today?
No, I don't, but they are in the back of my mind.
You've talked about writing as almost being therapy, as a healing process. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
I think that through writing, I exorcise my obsessions, my demons, my grief. The best example is after my daughter died, I wrote a memoir called Paula that allowed me, it was very cathartic because it allowed me to understand what had happened. The year of my daughter in a coma was a year of confusion in which every day seemed the same. And when I tried to remember what had happened, it was all foggy. And then by going day by day, reliving the year through the letters that I had written to my mother during that year, I reconstructed that reality, that universe, and could manage it better. So it helped me with the mourning process during the first year. But there are many other moments. I just went recently through a divorce after 28 years of marriage, and I thought that was going to be the man with whom I would die someday. So it was a painful process that, of course, took years to end in a divorce. Things don't happen in one day. And I wrote The Japanese Lover, which is an exploration of love. Why does love end? Why does love begin? Can love endure? What happens at all when you are old? Is it possible to fall in love? And all those questions. So writing that book was also very cathartic because it helped me with that transition.
Do you find yourself ever rereading, say, Paolo or The Japanese Lover to remind yourself of some of those sentiments?
No. If I need to remind myself of anything, I read my mother's letters. I write to her every day. And they are very well organized, the letters, chronologically, by month and by year. So if I want to remember what happened with Paola in July 1992, I just go to the file.
You write to your mother every day?
Every single day.
And you keep a copy at home to remind
yourself?
Yes.
Before I didn't, but she would give me back the letters. Now I keep a copy because my mom is 96 and she tends to forget a few things. Not many, though.
That's an incredible endeavor.
It's not an endeavor. Other people keep journals. I need someone to write to. For me, it's a way of keeping record of life. What I don't write to my mother never happened because the next day I will have forgotten it.
Just briefly going back to Paola, I want to mention it only because I want to highlight the incredible work you've done through your foundation, the Isabel Allende Foundation. Tell listeners the goal really of that foundation is around the world.
Well, when I wrote that book, Paola, I didn't want to touch any income that would come from the book. So I created a separate account and I was feeding that account without knowing what the heck I was going to do with it until the idea came of creating a foundation to honor my daughter. The mission of the foundation would be something that my daughter was always involved with. She always volunteered to work with women of high risk, of very low resources. So I did that. But then my daughter-in-law, Lori Barra, walked into our lives, changed my family and my life, and she took care of the foundation. And now the foundation is very well organized. We are very focused. And after the election of Trump, we have had to revise all our goals because our resources are limited. The only money that we have is the money I can provide for the foundation. And so we decided that we could not spread ourselves too thin. We were supporting more than 100 organizations. So now we cut it in half and we are focusing on the issues that we think are more at risk. Reproductive rights, violence against women, and economic equality or independence.
How present is the foundation, or I guess you vocally, in your native country, in Chile as well, where obviously reproductive rights are severely curtailed?
Chile is one of the, I think, 7 countries in the world where abortion is not accepted in any circumstances. So now a new law has passed the Congress, but it has to go to the Senate, in which there are 3 exceptions. One is immediate danger of death to the mother. The word immediate tells you something. The other one is if the fetus cannot live outside the uterus. And the other one is rape. And rape, which is rampant in Chile, and incest is too. That is what the Christian Democrats are objecting, because it's not life and death like the other two. So that is the situation with reproductive rights, and my foundation works actively with that. But in other issues, women in Chile have even more rights and they are better represented in Congress than in the United States.
You've been in the States a long time, but how do you feel about the current environment? I'm wondering if you've ever been tempted to leave, given what's happening.
Yes, absolutely. When Trump was elected, my first thought was, thank God, I have a place to go back. I can go back to Chile, and so can my son and my grandchildren. I don't think that we are in immediate danger, my family and I. We're all citizens here. But we are Latinos. And there is a point when xenophobia is blind, as we've seen in Europe, what happened in Germany. People think that that can never happen here, that this is a country made of immigrants, that the institutions are so strong that they can withstand any assault. But I've lived long enough to know that things can change very fast, and that if you have a mob mentality, almost anything can happen. So I'm cautious and I'm worried.
I mean, you've always been active. Do you think this election, has this spurred you on to perhaps do more?
Yes, but I'm not the only one. I mean, everybody is motivated. There has been a resistance that I find extraordinary and I find very hopeful. Not only because it's against this particular government, but because the country needed to be energized. I mean, if you have young people who are not interested in politics, who think that it doesn't concern them, it's very dangerous, because the few people who are active can do whatever they want. If there is no counterbalance, if there is no resistance, if there is no public opinion, if they curtail the press, and you have the Congress and the Senate in their pockets. So everything can be nepotism and corruption and political partidism, and forget the democracy. It can be really hurt.
Mm. You live in the US, but obviously you often write about Latin America or Chile. How much of an attachment do you still feel to that place of your younger years? How much of your soul, I guess, is still in South America?
I can only explain that by saying that I dream in Spanish, I curse in Spanish, I write in Spanish. My way of thinking is still very Chilean. The way I see family and the sense of loyalty or honor or relationships between men and women and between families, it's very Latin American, I'm afraid. And I'm afraid that I'm a foreigner here, but I'm a foreigner there too, because I've lived 40 years away from my country and 28 years in the United States. I live in English, really, but I think in Spanish. I would feel ridiculous making love in English, panting in English. Oh, how awful.
Some of us have to do it.
I know, but whoa, how terrible.
Do you think it's hard, though? You kind of just explain that almost third way, you know, not feeling that Chile is quite home or the US is quite home. Do you feel that that influences your writing, that sort of third way floating in the middle of two places?
It does. It gives me a very acute sense of place and time for every story that I write. But it allows me to float between time and space with great freedom. I can write about the Civil War in Spain or about the slave revolt in Haiti or about the conquest of Chile or about the gold rush. It doesn't matter. I feel that I belong in the world and that somehow time is relative, that I can be the slave 200 years ago, that I can be the pirate of the Caribbean. I can be anybody, anytime. Gives me a lot of freedom.
Talking about that freedom, I think your stepfather in the past has kind of criticized you slightly about how you see the past, which is different to how he's seen it.
Everybody sees it differently. Everybody has their, memory is like imagination. It's the same process in the brain. We think that we remember things, but we remember things differently from another person who was there at the same time and experienced the same thing, will remember it differently. Or maybe won't remember it at all.
Is it fair to say it's romanticized or dramatized?
Yes, yes.
And he objects to that?
Probably. My son does too, because he's a very reasonable Zen person. But but I have to say that, what do you remember of your life? The highlights and the lowlights, the drama. I mean, the grace in between are lost, really lost. So our lives, our memories, our biographies are made of these highlights and lowlights. What happens with me is that I tend to exaggerate the extremes. So I live more in the extremes. I was talking with my daughter-in-law recently, and she says that I live in a story. And if I am, let's say, with a man that I'm interested in, does he have a story? It's important, because if he doesn't have a story, I will make it up.
And what do you mean, an interesting story about his past?
Of course. I will enlarge it or paint it in different colors.
What, when you
I'm
tell
sorry,
people
but my
about
brain my brain works that way, works in stories. And dogs. I can always remember a dog and a story. And nothing
That's
else.
That's a great quote.
And
I'm
nothing
quote you
else.
There, Isabel Allende. In fact, I should tell listeners that when you arrived at the studio here, where you've been before, you couldn't really remember why you'd been here before, but you could remember a dog.
There was a dog that ate the furniture.
Now, obviously, when people think of the Allende name now because of your, you know, amazing career, they think of Isabel Allende. But obviously, you are related to the deposed former president of Chile, Salvador Allende. I just wanted to know, because I'm intrigued, what your memories of him were when you were in Chile before you left.
I have two kinds of memories. The memories before he was president, and he was a member of the family. He was my father's cousin, and my father left my mother when I was 3 years old, and I never saw my father again. He sort of disappeared forever. And the only person from the Allende family that remained close to my mother was Salvador Allende, his wife and his daughters. So I grew up having some relationship with them as relatives. Then he became president. And then I saw him in a completely different light. He appointed my stepfather ambassador to Argentina, which is, as you know, an hour away by plane. So every 2 months, more or less, my stepfather would come to report to the government, and we would have a chance to have a family luncheon or dinner with Allende. So then I remember him as the politician, the statesman. And I would say that he had many extraordinary qualities and extraordinary defects. One of the defects was that he liked women a lot, that he was very bourgeois and he represented the people, and he was not forgiven for using Italian jackets, for example, or Gucci shoes, if there were any Gucci shoes at the time, I don't remember. He collected art. He was very refined and a bon vivant in many ways. Incredibly smart.
Inspiring.
Very inspiring, very smart, very charismatic, and with a sense of humor, self-deprecating humor. Very quick with a reply. His mind worked like multitasked all the time. They say that, this I cannot confirm, but they say that he slept very few hours. He would play chess with a friend of mine until very late in the evening. And he would get all his briefings early in the morning and could remember everything perfectly. And then he would have short naps in the car, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, and that would freshen him up again. So he had a very particular kind of brain.
And he was good at power naps, it seems.
Yeah, but also he was a very courageous man, a man who followed his principles and was courageous to the very end. And I find that really admirable.
I mean, obviously you were forced to leave because of the dictatorship and went to live in Venezuela in exile. How much do you find yourself thinking about those early days of the dictatorship, the coup, those, I guess, painful and disturbing times in Chilean history? Is it something you still think about now?
All the time. And I write about it all the time. I just finished another book called In the Midst of Summer. There are three characters in the book, three characters only. And one of them is a Chilean journalist who has written about the coup and whose brother has disappeared. So the memories of that time and what happened in Chile left profound scars in the society, and the scars will be there for generations, I think.
Earlier in the interview, you mentioned how, you know, you think, you dream, you write in Spanish. Now, we're having a conversation in English. You're completely fluent. Do you just feel that you need to write in Spanish because your voice is different in English? What makes you want to continue just writing in Spanish?
Look, in Spanish, I'm really smart and funny.
What, you saying you're not in English?
No. I always feel, in English, I feel like 14, you know. Writing is something that happens more in the belly than in the brain. It's very instinctual, organic. I start with a little thread that can be an idea, let's say a brownstone in Brooklyn. And then it starts opening up and it goes in directions that are totally unexpected. And that process, I don't think about it too much. It just starts to happen inside me, and it happens in Spanish.
I'm really interested because of, you know, the fact that you write in Spanish, and yet obviously you're translated into several different languages. But I think there's one woman who's translated a lot of your work into English. I'm interested to know, I guess, the kind of symbiosis, the relationship you have with the translator, and does it make you very close? Because she's in charge of really conveying yourself and your words and getting it just right in another language.
That was the case with Margaret Sawyer Peden, who translated 19 of my books, or 20. And she's now retired, and she doesn't feel that she wants to keep on working. She's probably way over 80 now. So I have had translators for my last three books, and the relationship has not been close, but I get the text and I read line by line. So if I find something, I point it out. Usually it's, let's say, irony is the first thing that is lost, because irony is also very particular to a place. What might be ironic in Chile might be politically incorrect in the United States. Well, everything is politically incorrect here. I mean, it's really boring. The other day I was walking my dog and someone said, "What kind of dog is yours?" And I said, "Oh, just a mutt." I said, "You should never say that in front of the dog. Mixed breed."
Because they understand.
So irony can be lost.
So what makes you want to keep writing? What kind of stokes your fire to keep writing after all these years?
My love of stories and the fact that I am unemployable. Who would give me a job? Nobody. So I really love storytelling. I finish a book and immediately there's another one coming, and I can't stop it.
And you just don't know where these stories come from?
No, I don't know where the stories come from.
You ever worried that, you know, that might stop? Do you ever panic that you might suddenly...
No, my panic is that I won't be able to write them, that writing becomes slower, that I might lose my capacity for attention and memory and focusing and the capacity of just sitting down 10 hours a day. I can't do it anymore. So I have a desk that goes up and down so that I can be standing some part of the work. But even so, it's hard on my body now. Time, as you get older, goes so fast, so fast. Before I could do so many things, and now I can't.
Do you find that your writing is influenced by, say, what's happening in your personal life or what's happening in politics? How much do outside influences affect your writing?
I don't know exactly, because in the long run, everything that happens affects me. When I was living the military coup or exile in Venezuela, I couldn't write about it. I could write about it many, many years later when somehow I had sorted it out inside me. Then I write about something that I say, why am I writing about this? It doesn't concern me at all. It's not connected to my country, to my past, to my culture, like the slave revolt in Haiti 200 years ago. What is the connection? But I am obsessed. And for 4 years, I research and I write a book. And then when the book is done, I realize that I have been writing about something that has always been an obsession, and that is power with impunity. The impunity to abuse power.
Do you always feel that you need to find that personal connection in order to sort of link yourself almost to your work?
I don't when I am doing it, but later I discovered that there is always a connection. I write about the gold rush, and it's not really about the gold rush. It's about feminism. It's about a young girl in Victorian times that defies the world, crosses the world, and goes into an all-masculine world of testosterone, which is the gold rush, and makes it there. So it's always about... It's a metaphor of something that is really important in my life. Otherwise, I couldn't, for example, I can't write a book about Wall Street because I'm not interested. It doesn't affect me. It's not, I don't have any connection. But I can write about refugees.
You talked about time speeding up, all these things you want to do. Do you have a clear idea of certain books that you still want to write? Give us an idea of what's kind of on your to-do list of what you still want to write about or achieve in your literary career?
I don't think of the future. I think of the next book only. I've just finished In the Midst of Winter. Now I am preparing, doing all the research for another book that I will start next January 8th. That book starts in the Civil War in Spain. So that's my research at this point. Where it's going to lead, I don't know yet. But I already have a time and a place.
And you always start your books on January the 8th?
Yes, but people think it's superstition. There's part of it, but it's mostly discipline. My life is complicated, and I need to organize my calendar and clear my mind and my social life and everything in order to be available for the book, completely available. So January 8th is a good time because it's after the holidays. Everybody's going back to work, and it's winter. It's a time of introspection. It's good. So I lock myself in my house with my dog, and I have a great time.
Back to dogs again. Well, Isabel Yende, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you and talking to you again. I always enjoy it.
Well,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Big Interview is produced by Guy Lutz and edited by Dia Scissor. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.